Our final speaker in this morning's session is Marilyn Cruickshank from the Commission. Please welcome Marilyn.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Claire. And thank you also to the ACCA conference organisers for inviting the Commission to come and speak to you today. Chris Bagley sends his apologies both to you, Claire, and also to the organising committee and also to the audience for not being able to come and talk today. I would say that his heart is with us, but unfortunately Chris has asked me to tell you that he's suffering from atrial fibrillation, so I don't think we better not put any stress on his heart at all at the moment. So hopefully he'll be well again shortly and be up and about again and be able to fly. So just to start off, I know I've shown this slide to people before, but I think whenever we talk about healthcare-associated infections, it's always important to think back about why we do this work. And just to go back to just some real basics, whenever patients come into the healthcare system, you know, they have a certain expectations. And we as healthcare workers also share those expectations. So going into hospital or going to see your doctor or going to a clinic, we don't expect that patients will become infected by their experience there, either from the surroundings or from the healthcare workers who don't clean their hands. When they're given medications, patients expect that they'll actually get the right medications at the right time. They won't get somebody else's medications. If they have need to be assessed for any other risks, such as a VTE, that those procedures will actually be in place. And if they have any tests, procedures, operations or x-rays, that they'll actually get the ones that they're expecting to get that were ordered for them. They'll get the right ones in the right place at the right time and they won't get anybody else's treatment. And if something goes wrong and their condition deteriorates, that not only will somebody know, but they'll also do something about it. So this is really what the work of the Commission's about. So just to put this into a little bit of a perspective as well, experience an adverse event in an intensive care unit, a patient has 1 in 2 chance of that. That's quite high. If you fall over in hospital, you'll have a 1 in 2 chance of hurting yourself and being injured. If you have an adverse event in ICU, it's usually serious enough to cause death or disability in 1 in 10 cases. The same if you have an adverse event or a near miss in hospital. A little bit higher if you have a complication from medication or a drug, it's only 1 in 20 chances. Or developing a hospital-acquired infection, 1 in 30 chances. Still quite high when you think about the number of patients who come into health services. I don't know how well you can see this this slide, but last month I had the opportunity to attend the REACT meeting in Uppsala in Sweden. This was a meeting to discuss the global response to antimicrobial resistance. So this is a slide which I hope you can see. But it just shows the beginning of each of these blue lines show the year that these different antibiotics were developed and put into use. And the end of the line is when there were case reported of antimicrobial resistance. So you can see up here in the 1940s and the 1950s, some of these were quite long. But when you get down here to the 2000s, some of these lines are very, very short. Also, the discovery of new classes of antibiotics has been decreasing, with few classes discovered in the past 40 years. The number of antibiotics submitted to the United States FDA has also decreased over the past 10 years. As to a new antibiotics under development, and less than 2% of research and development programs of the world's largest 15 pharmaceutical companies are antibiotics. So we're really running out of antibiotics, and action is required not only locally but also nationally and internationally. So just to talk about the work of the Commission, many of you know that the Commission is funded by and reports to 9 health ministers. So if you think that reporting to one Department of Health can be a little bit frustrating, try reporting and trying to get consensus among 9. So the Commission commenced in January 2006. We work with policymakers from all the jurisdictions and from private hospital sectors and primary care. The Commission had a lifespan until the end of 2010, and last year we underwent a process of review, And now the Commission has been firmly established in the National Health and Hospitals Network Bill, which was presented to the new government into Parliament last week. In 2007, when the HII program started, we found that there was no systematic Australia-wide approach to HII in Australia. I just need to get a mouthful of water just a second. So the result of scoping in 2007, when the HII program started, really showed that there was no systematic Australia-wide approach to HAIs. There was considerable variation across the country. There were small groups, large groups, doing lots of really good work, but really no overall coordination. Many of the initiatives had been developed, a number of reports. There was the Jetta report, there was National Surveillance in 2001, an excellent report, National Strategy in 2003, there was an advisory committee set up in 2004, Andy Ager put out an excellent paper in 2006. So despite all these excellent reports with great advice, some of them well-costed, and many of them endorsed by health ministers, there wasn't really much happening nationally. So in May 2007, we put together an HII prevention program at the Commission, and we chose five priority areas. So these were around HII surveillance, clinical capacity building, especially for people working in infection prevention, infection control guidelines, a national hand hygiene program, and antimicrobial stewardship. This is the work plan from the Commission. So you can see that the 20 or so staff who work there have a lot of work to do. This diagram just shows all the programs, and this part here is the HAI part of the program. And there you can see in red the number of papers that have gone to health ministers. The ones in dark red have been endorsed, and the ones in light red, such as the implementation for the guidelines, reports to ministers and antimicrobial stewardship and education modules are either going to health ministers in November this year or early next year. So quite a lot of work going on at the Commission. Within the HII program, we have a number of committees. And these committees are very thoughtfully thought out, I think, for their membership. So the main committee we now have is the HAI Advisory Committee, which is really about authority and leadership within the HAI community. Attached to that is a new committee, just recently formed a couple of months ago, called the Technical Working Party. And this working party really is the bridge between the work that the Commission undertakes and the jurisdictional surveillance units. We also have some committees, such as the Infection Control Guidelines and the Antimicrobial Stewardship Committee, which are almost entirely composed of clinical experts for their advice and input. And then we have two other committees, the Implementation Advisory Committee and the Hand Hygiene Committee, which are really more concerned with implementation of those projects. I'll just tell you a little bit about each of the projects. So HAI surveillance, in 2008, health ministers endorsed recommendations from our blue book, and if you'd like to see a copy of our book, it's on our website. So the recommendations that were prioritised by 50 experts from across the country was that all hospitals should establish HAI surveillance, and that all hospitals should monitor and report into a national data collection Staph aureus bacteremia and Clostridium difficile. More recently, the core hospital-based outcome indicators for safety and quality also include healthcare-associated staph bacteremia and also C. difficile. So what have we been doing since 2008, since we had these endorsements? Well, first of all, there have been some national definitions of healthcare-associated SAB and CDI. This has been a really difficult piece of work to achieve. And if you want to know the details about this, Helen Van Gessel and I are going to be talking about this afternoon in one of the workshops. We've also put together a data dictionary for healthcare-associated SAB and CDI, and these have been lodged into Meteor. And we've also been putting together some implementation guidelines to assist people at the local hospital level to be able to undertake that data collection for SAB and CDI. We also have been undertaking some standardised laboratory requesting and reporting work so that all laboratories will have a consensus and standardised way of reporting back for these healthcare-associated infections. In August this year, the Commission put together a Clostridium difficile work to assist jurisdictions in coping with the hypervirulent strain of C. difficile that had been discovered in Victoria. And we have plans afoot to work with ACID to undertake a national snapshot study of C. difficile in starting October. So as soon as the jurisdictions sign off on that. Another of our projects around surveillance is the Central Line Associated Bacteremia, or the CLAB project, that we're working in collaboration with ANZACS. So this was endorsed by the jurisdictions in June 2010, and it builds very much on the work that presently been undertaken by the jurisdictions. And Gabby Hanlon, who's the project manager for this, will be speaking this afternoon also about the project. So if you want to know more about this, come and listen to Gabby. In terms of clinical capacity building, we've put together an implementation advisory committee, which I'm sure most of you are quite aware of. And this has representatives from all the ACA states and territories. And it brings together the clinical, academic and professional and research expertise from across Australia. So some of the work that this committee's been very instrumental in is to give input from an infection control practitioner perspective into each of our five projects. Also, part of the work was to undertake literature review and review of infection control programs, which was put into a document called Elements of Infection Control Program. And the really exciting part of this project was that it forms the basis of the management and clinical governance section in the new Australian guidelines. Another part of the work from the implementation committee has been to propose and develop some education modules for use by those staff who work in smaller hospitals and without the support from infectious diseases specialists, and who might just work one or two days a week, or might be very new to the position, or perhaps even work as link nurses. These education modules were developed by a team from Southern Health in Victoria, and they're completed, I think, just about this week. So if you'd like to have a look at these education modules, please come around to the ACE stall, and Sue Gregg will be only too happy to demonstrate these modules to you. So the modules comprise 10 online interactive sessions, and they really cover all the basics and everything you need to know to undertake infection control and prevention. If you undertake these modules, you can print out a certificate and to show that you've been able to pass the assessment. So these modules have a whole range of content. So they have pictures, they have assessments, they have links, they're interactive, there's further reading and bibliography. So everything you'd want to know about those topics, I'm sure. So today I'm very pleased to be able to announce that the infection control guidelines that we've been waiting for the last 2 years are now in print. They're now on the NHMRC website. And they have been developed... They have been developed by a great team of people from NHMRC, Tanya Farmer and Stephanie Goodrick and Kathy Mitchell. And the steering committee was really well supported from across Australia. So they included Anne Kohler, Nick Demiduke, Chris Bagley, Silva Gandossi, Karen Christensen, Tom Gottlieb, Liz Coates, Brett Mitchell, Peter Collignon, Peter Morris, Celia Cooper and Claire Boardman. So congratulations to all of them, and this is a document that we've been waiting for the last 2 years. I just want to say, though, about the guidelines and about the steering committee, that everybody on that steering committee worked extremely hard over those 2 years. It was not an easy process, and the time that it took for the steering committee was really, really onerous. But there are two people that I really need to thank on behalf of probably all of us here for the work that they did on getting these guidelines finished, and that's Sylvia Gandossi and Brett Mitchell. You did great, guys. The two of them spent hundreds of hours going through every word in this document, so now you know who to blame if there's a problem. Not really, no. But they did a great job, really over and beyond the call of duty. So I think if ACA hands out gold medals, they both should get one for their work on that document. So the new guidelines are a little different to the old guidelines. Hopefully many of you have seen copies of them on the website when they went out for consultation. So really set around core practice principles, really looking at risk management assessment and being able to be used right across the health spectrum. So supporting the use of the guidelines, something that is new, that this is the first time that national guidelines have come out in Australia with a whole suite of supporting resources for implementation. So the Commission, together with NH and MRC, are organising a series of workshops and events to give people some clues about how to go about implementing these guidelines. We've also developed a whole suite of resources around an electronic learning tool that could be used, for example, in orientation. We've also put together two implementation guides and also some resources for clinical educators to be able to talk about doing a risk assessment when they have students in hospitals as well. So the guidelines target everybody who works in hospitals, including doctors, nurses, ancillary staff, wardsmen and cleaners, right through the whole gambit of healthcare workers. And the implementation strategies are going on their way to health ministers to be endorsed. As I mentioned, we have an Aussie implementation guide and toolkit. We have one for acute care hospitals and also a separate one for primary care workers. And this is part of any of you who were at the session yesterday on the guideline implementation, this will be one of our main pieces of work that we'll be using. So another of the projects is the National Hand Hygiene Initiative, and I'm not going to talk too much about this because I'm sure you're all really aware of it. And Phil Russo is going to be doing a talk this afternoon as well, so he'll give you a good update on everything that's happening about the National Hand Hygiene Program. But as most of you probably know, that this is the only National Hand Hygiene Program that has both process and outcome measures in the world. So this is a first as well. It standardises hand hygiene practice across the country, so no matter where you work, public or private hospital, which state or territory, everyone does hand hygiene the same way. This is just showing you here from the latest lots of audits that registered nurses and midwives still way ahead in the compliance rates, but still only just about 70%. And as we saw from earlier talks today, actually, that healthcare workers are still more concerned about protecting themselves from infection than protecting their patients. So still a bit of work to do. But one of the really pleasing things is that over 100,000 healthcare workers have undertaken the education module since that program started less than 2 years ago. So that's really been a great achievement. Another exciting initiative that started this year is that Nick Graves from QUT, who many of you would know and one of his papers was quoted earlier today, was successful in getting an NH and MRC partnership project grant to be able to undertake the evaluation of the National Hand Hygiene Project. So this is very exciting, and I hope that many of you will be involved in this education project as well. So what are they going to look at in terms of hand hygiene? Well, what sort of factors, other than hand hygiene compliance, affect rates of healthcare-associated SAB? So Nick and his team are going to be looking at what other factors at hospital and both healthcare worker level might influence the levels of SAB. And also, is hand hygiene intervention a cost-effective use of scarce health resources? what we're expecting that the research will show is whether other factors that are associated with positive outcomes, how the effects vary across Australian healthcare workers and hospitals, whether it's cost effective as a national policy. So very good information for us at the Commission since we're funding this project. And whether hand hygiene interventions should be targeted as based on value for money. And hopefully this will allow policy makers to decide how hand hygiene interventions should be organised and how to target healthcare spending. So, a great project. Another of our projects at the Commission is antimicrobial stewardship. So the aim of this project is to promote the optimal use of antibiotics while trying to minimise the impact of resistance on the community. So another committee that we have at the Commission has put together an enormous piece of work for implementation of antimicrobial stewardship in hospitals. And going with that book will also be some education modules aimed at antimicrobial prescribers. And we're hoping to hold an antimicrobial stewardship forum early next year and also conduct a workshop on antimicrobial usage data as well with NORSP. So there's been some comments made by Claire this morning and Norman Swan yesterday about the Commission's accreditation program and standards for infection control. So I just wanted to make a couple of points about this as well. The National Safety and Quality Health Service standards are part of the new accreditation program, which will be coming into place in about 2012. There are a number of standards, and one of the standards are around healthcare-associated infection. There are six elements within these standards. One is around systems and governance, another around policies and protocols, another around how organisations manage patients with infections, another around antimicrobial stewardship, another cleaning, disinfection, sterilisation, and another on consumer information. These standards have already been piloted in 28 sites, and as you know, they're out for consultation. We'd be really pleased to get your input into these standards. Just before I finish up, I just wanted to just make a couple of notes. So in the 3 years since the project started, and in the 3 years since I first met many of you in Hobart, we can ask our question, have we really gone anywhere that we haven't gone before in terms of national HAI work? Well, in some ways we have. We've got a national hand hygiene program that's different to any other in the world. We've got a series of implementation resources for guidelines which we haven't had before. We've got education modules for training and education of infection control prevention staff. We've also got implementation strategies for antimicrobial stewardship that we haven't had before. So where does that leave us in the future? Well, sort of a bit of a hard question to answer, because part of that answer is dependent on the role of the Commission. Many of you probably know that the last day of Kevin Rudd's premiership, Prime Ministership, the National Hospital and Healthcare paper was presented to Parliament. Unfortunately, there wasn't another Parliament sitting for that to be voted on, so we've had to wait until last week. So that has been presented to Parliament again, twice. We now have to wait for the November break until that can be debated in Parliament. There may be some amendments to that. And then it has to be passed by the Senate. And as you know, with our political climate, anything could happen. So in some ways, when that will all happen is not in our hands. But the good thing is that the new reform package does put safety and quality for patients right in the very centre of the health reform package. And the Commission's work is also seen to be very central to that. So that's a good thing. The other thing is too that the Commission is going to be independent. So although we will still report, be funded by and report to the nine health ministers, we will be completely independent. And so the new independent commission, as the commission is now as well, we are in a position where we won't be bought and we won't be bribed and we won't be bullied into doing things that we don't think is right. A year or so ago, one of the members of our implementation advisory committee told one of our other colleagues that she thought that working with the commission was a little bit like being in free fall. So I don't know who it was that said that, but I hope they finally found the ground. But all I can say is that for the future and for the next few years, the work around national HAI is going to still be an incredible journey, and I invite you to come along with us all. Thanks.
Thanks, Marilyn. And I remember, as many of you would, that first meeting that we had in Hobart. It was fairly colourful, I guess. And the coming years, as I mentioned yesterday afternoon, for Marilyn at times it's probably been like trying to herd cats. In my presentation this morning, I spoke about the need for all infection control professionals to have input into the healthcare standards. An email was circulated via the ACA list, but also through the e-bulletin that ACA puts out now. We have asked for and been granted a one-week extension because the feedback was for this Friday. And for those of you who aren't actively engaged, on the ACA website, in the members-only section, all the reports from all our representatives on all the committees are there. So if you're looking for some answers and some direction, it is all there. You just need to log in. So we've got time for some questions. If you can please come to one of the microphones in the aisles. Marilyn, I would like to congratulate again the Commission on the NHMRC Infection Control Guidelines. It was met with applause throughout the audience. Can you talk about what's... Unfortunately, I wasn't able to get to the session yesterday because I was in another one. For those who weren't in the session yesterday, can you please just tell the audience how that might be rolled out now? So if you're not at this ACA meeting, how will the information be imparted to the broader infection control community?
Thanks, Claire. Well, firstly, the guidelines are on the NHMRC website. So if you rush out now or go home tonight and try and find them, you might find it a little bit difficult because I've only just gone on. The portal hasn't been developed yet. But if you go to the NHMRC website and you put in the search there, infection control, you'll find the new guidelines. The guidelines have been designed so that you can do a search and find once you get into them on the website. So you don't have to, and you can print out lots of separate parts of the guidelines as well, so you don't have to print out a whole big PDF file to find one bit of information. So hopefully it will be very easy for you to find out. Secondly, about implementation and how can you get some help in implementing the guidelines. The Commission has written to every state and territory about a week ago offering the services of NHMRC and the Commission to conduct workshops very similarly to the one that we had yesterday. So we have said that we would be happy to run workshops in each capital city and also in regions for wherever the separate departments think would be necessary. We're also happy to run workshops in collaboration with ACA and also through the divisions of general practitioners as well. In addition, there's also the a whole list of resources that will go through it, such as the Aussie Guide and standardised signage and a whole lot of other things. And they can all be accessed through the NHMRC website and also through the Commission over the next couple of weeks and months.
Thanks, Marilyn. Yes, Beth, is it? Beth, can you go to the microphone on that side? Because I don't think there's one there. I think it's a stand.
Yeah. So I just wonder, will we get hard copies of the...
The question is, will we get hard copies of the NHMRC guidelines?
No, you don't want hard copies because they've been designed actually to find the information quicker on the web. If you want a hard copy, you can print it out. but we're not going to print out loads of hard copies for two reasons. One is that the last 2 years of developing the guidelines has really been resource intensive. We don't want to go through that process every 2 or 5 years. What we want to do is to have put in place a process where the guidelines are continually updated as new evidence comes into being. So this will mean that whenever you go to the website to look at the information on the guidelines, the information there is current.
Is there any other questions? Yes, just in the... Oh, Gertie.
I have a question about the guidelines. Are they free available and also for non-members of ICA?
They're free for everybody. Just go and have a look on the website and they're there.
ACA works quite closely with the Commission, but the NHMRC infection control guidelines are broadly available to everybody.
Yes, as are all the materials as well, the implementation materials.
Okay, is there any other questions? No, well please join me in thanking our speakers from this morning, perhaps.